I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss the renowned author and illustrator Edward Gorey and his life on Cape Cod. He was also a set and costume designer, earning a Tony Award in 1979 for his Broadway production of Dracula. And of course, if you're a fan of the PBS mystery series, you've seen the animated sequences of his work. Christopher Seifert was working on a documentary of Edward Gorey when he died in 2000. He joins us in studio in Woods Hole. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you.
And Edward's first cousin once removed, Ken Morton, was working on another project in the works that documents Edward's days on the Cape in photographs. Good morning to you, Ken.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Okay, so I don't know which one of you wants to do this, but for those who are going, Edward Gorey, who is it? Just describe his work.
Well, as you said, the piece that most people recognize is the animation introducing mystery on PBS. Exactly. And the second thing that most people know, even if they don't know they know Edward Gorey, is the Gashly Crumb Tiny's alphabet of the 26 children meeting their demise in one way or another. A is for Amy, who fell down the stairs. B is for Basil, assaulted by bears, and so on through the alphabet.
Yeah. And actually, at the Edward Gorey House, we'll talk a little about that a little later, which is now a museum, you have a sort of a scavenger hunt of all of those. You have the little doll, Amy, who's falling down the stairs and so on.
Right. Yeah. All the 26 deaths are represented in one way or another. It's great for the kids, and it's a lot of fun.
All right. So when you started this project, Chris, you didn't know who Edward Gorey was, right?
No, I was probably unique in that way. I was probably one of the few people that sort of came into his world that didn't have an appreciation for his work particularly.
So how did you get involved in this? How did this come about?
I can go on for a long time about that, so I'll make it as short as possible. But my background was initially in journalism, and then moving into more idealistic filmmaking, anthropological filmmaking. And I went to grad school for that out west. And essentially the type of thing where you go embed yourself with a disappearing culture in the rainforest of South America, and come back, 2 years later, 4 years later, 6 years later, with a film that shows that particular culture's point of view, and not your own point of view, mm-hmm. and not your comment on that point of view, but their point of view. And that's the way I went into the film with Edward Gorey. As someone fresh out of grad school with a very idealistic type of filmmaking, it was not – that was in the days before reality television. Mm. So
you approach Edward with this idea to do this documentary, and he said he actually was sort of tickled you didn't know who he was.
I think so. I had been going around that whole summer. I had just moved back from Australia. I lived down there for a while. And so I was sort of fresh back off the boat back on the Cape where I grew up, and kept hearing people kept – I was saying I was a documentary maker, and people kept always want to tell you – what you should do next. And I kept hearing the name, Edward Gorey. There's this guy, a very eccentric artist living in Yarmouth. And he's a total recluse and all sorts of stories about what he might be doing in that house of his. You should go, film him. And I kept hearing this over and over. And I have my own ideas and a long list of them. So I wasn't really jumping on that. But after a while, you hear this over and over. And I finally looked him up in the bookstore and Yellow Umbrella and Chatham. And I just didn't get the work at all. But I realized looking at it that this was a significant artist with mm-hmm. a prolific output and someone that just the world should know about. And so I wrote him a letter. Really with the idea that he would say no and I could be done with it. But he called me back, left this message on my answer machine, which I just wish I kept to this day, but saying that he would be open to it, but they actually have some plays coming up and he'd like to hire me to document them. So I called him back and I said, whatever it takes, I'll shoot all this stuff for free. Why don't we consider it test footage for the documentary?
Wow.
And I'll shoot whatever
1995? You need. It was 96. Okay. So you started.
August 96.
Yeah. All right. Ken, he just said people said he was a recluse. That's that's not exactly accurate.
Not exactly. And I want to back up it for a second. I think that Edward probably found Chris appealing exactly because Chris wasn't a big fan. Mm-hmm. I think Edward was a little leery of the deranged fan. Edward was out and about in Yarmouthport every day. Had breakfast and lunch at Jack's Outback every single day. And if you wanted to find him, he was easy to find.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't mind fans coming up and asking him for autographs and things. I mean, he did it whether he minded.
He
or
did
not.
It. He was very congenial about it. Mm-hmm. I think again, it had a little bit to do with the attitude and approach of the person.
Right. You know,
if they were sort of too fawning, he would feel embarrassed and kind of and be turned off.
Yeah, and he was in the phone book.
He was in the phone book.
Kind of amazing.
I think that's how I found him. I had his address and just mailed it to him. Yeah.
All right. So we mentioned Edward died in 2000. So what's taken so long to get this film to completion?
Oh, God.
You're expecting that to be this year, 2014, right?
Yeah. You know, I told Ken, you know, in a parallel universe, I'm still shooting this. You know, I started out as a young man and I'm now in my 40s. But in a parallel universe, Edward's 88, and I was settled in for the long haul on this. I wasn't just shooting for a couple of years and then going to rush something out. So when he died, I wasn't really prepared to really even face it or really to spit this stuff back out. I was in no rush, and I was still getting to know his work, you know. You know, his estate as a nonprofit makes it a little red tapey, but primarily, I moved on to other projects, and I was young and, you know, funding everything on my own, and I didn't really have the money to release the film then and just put it into, you know, other projects. I did a documentary with Suzanne Vega and one with Albert Maisel, and that's where my time and money and attention was going.
But this little voice keeps calling you back.
Yeah.
And you've been working on it a little bit, a little here, a little bit there.
And then I got married and had kids, and my priorities shifted a little bit. Yeah. But, we're coming out of that. My youngest is three, and I'm ready to get back on the horse on this. I've been getting phone calls from distributors all over the world, and film festivals want to premiere it sight unseen, which I can appreciate because I've been rejected twice at Sundance with other films. and the plan is to take this to Sundance. But and people just saying, how can I see this? There's just so many people that want this. And Edward wanted this film to happen for whatever strange reason of his own. He really wanted it, and I'm determined to get it out. And what I have here is, you know, Edward himself, and it's not an A&E biography. Edward was born in Chicago, blah blah blah, and it's not a study of his work. It's really kind of the quirky guy behind the work and how he's different and similar to that work in all those moments. So. It is something that will get out. I'm just taking my sweet time about it.
And lucky for us, you've brought some clips along today so that we get to sample some of this. Let's start with talking a little bit about his years in New York. Now, he was in New York for how long?
Well, I know what he left New York in 1990 for good when he moved into what's now the Edward Gorey House. He grew up in Chicago, went to college at Harvard, and then was in New York, I guess, pretty much from graduating from college through till when he moved to the Cape full time.
Mm-hmm. And he didn't spend many evenings at home.
I think in all the years I was in New York, I was never home one night. I mean, I was always out at something, you know, and I never get home until it was time to go to bed, so to speak, and stuff. Yeah, but there were times I think, what am I going to do tonight? And I'd pick up the New York Times, and I've seen every movie. There isn't a play I want to see. There's not a concert, not an opera, not a ballet, not a this, that, or the other thing. And I thought, I'm bored, bored, bored. Where could I go? So it's all in your mind. Yes, it is. It's all in your mind. I just assume I'll be bored out of my wits on Cape Cod. I mean, I haven't been back to New York for about 13 years, I think. So I don't miss it, I must say.
Thought he'd be bored on Cape Cod, but no, he was kept busy.
Well, it's funny that he would think of New York as a boring place.
Right.
And, you know, as when I was growing up with him, he always, one of his catchphrases was, oh, the terrible tedium of it all, and commented over and over about there was nothing to see on TV, there were no movies, and And as he just said in that clip, you might as well be on the Cape Board, where it's peaceful and quiet.
Now, you said he moved here in 1990 full time.
That was actually 1986.
1986, okay. And but before that, the family vacationed here, right? It was placed in Barnstable.
We had a summer home in Barnstable. That's actually where I live now. Mm-hmm. And my grandparents and Edward and my aunt and my parents and myself spent summers there. And Edward spent some of the shoulder seasons there, spring and fall, alone working. Mm-hmm. He did a lot of work on the Cape.
Right. And so your mom is one of the deranged cousins.
My mom is one of the deranged cousins, and Elizabeth Morton, and my aunt Eleanor Garvey is the third. Edward being the first, of course.
Exactly, and they're not deranged. As
they're
you
not
said
deranged. For those who don't know, the deranged cousins is actually the title of one of his books.
Exactly, exactly. All right, and then we have another clip from New York, and this, I guess, Chris speaks to how he feels about the city. Is that what would you say about this clip?
Yeah, he basically says he never liked it.
I moved there in 1953.
I found myself, it was like, going to a strange country.
It changed so much all the time that, I'd find it hard to remember. I'd think, what used to be there? This wasn't here, 2 months ago. What was there beforehand? I'd never be able to remember. And I guess now things like 42nd Street with all the movies being refurbish in the theaters and Disney all over the place and everything, I'm sure I wouldn't recognize. And Times Square was really geared up for, vast change about the time I was leaving. And of course all the cineplexes were opening up, 22 movies where one had been before, which I'd never thought of before. I mean, I just, I never paid the slightest bit of attention really to people be mugged, murdered, blah, 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 but I never was, so. But, there wasn't any place where something might not happen to you, so why worry? I know people, terrible things more or less happen to them, on Central Park and, all sorts, any place, however elegant the address and whatnot. And so I just figured, well, something's going to happen to you. It's going to happen to you. You might as well just, because you could quite easily find yourself being afraid to go out after dark or even in daylight for that matter. And you think, well, that's not worth it. But I don't know. There are all sorts of things. If I were in New York, of course, there are a lot more things I'd be doing down there than I am here. But I don't miss doing them, so. And I really didn't like the place all that much.
So let's talk about his fashion sense in New York. He was known for those fur coats, the jeans and the sneakers and carrying the book.
And lots of jewelry.
Lots of jewelry, exactly.
You can hear that clanking through all the interviews.
The rings.
The large bronze African heavy necklaces banging against the microphone and the rings.
Yeah. But somewhere along the line, he had about 20 of those fur coats, Ken?
That's about right. Yeah.
And somewhere along, he had a change of heart.
He had a change of, many of us had a change of heart about wearing fur in general. And he specifically did and ended up putting them all into cold storage sometime in the 80s and never wore them again. And interestingly, he left his entire estate, as Chris mentioned, to various animal charities, managed under the auspices of the Edward Gorey Charitable Trust. And a few years back, we auctioned off all the fur coats, and the money went to the Edward Gorey House and to the animal charities.
Right, and you had a cat. I haven't been back there since 2009, and it was like this was the hugest cat I've ever seen. It was like 20 something pounds.
He was a big, sweet, fat cat named Ombledroom, mm-hmm. Who unfortunately passed away a couple of years ago. So the Edward Gorey House is at the moment without a cat.
Without a cat, you think you'll get another one? Maybe.
Wouldn't rule it out.
All right, we're talking about Edward Gorey's life on Cape Cod, and we'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Edward Gorey's days on Cape Cod with filmmaker Christopher Seifert, who's working on a documentary, The Last Days of Edward Gorey, and Edward's first cousin once removed, Ken Morton, who is also working on a project of photographs of Edward Gorey's life on Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. If you have a story about Edward Gorey you'd like to share with us, 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Ken, tell us about the project you're working on.
Sure. My aunt, Eleanor Garvey, again, one of the deranged cousins, took up photography as a hobby in 1961. And at the time, the family summer home in Barnstable Village was a tiny house on the edge of a marsh. And it often got claustrophobic. And so the family would go on picnics and just exploratory cruises around Cape Cod. And Eleanor tagged along with her camera. And from about 1961 to 1985, she took many, many photos, many of which are nice shots of Edward Gorey. And I've been curating her photos and putting them together in a way that I think will be appealing.
Mm. So it's going to be so more of a picture book. Will there be some copy in that as well?
It's mainly a photography book. Mm-hmm. I'm writing a little essay in explaining the context of it. You know, there'll be captions and dates and so on.
Well, that's sort of interesting. So you've got sort of that 60s and 70s, 80s is sort of your time frame with him. And then Chris kind of takes over in the 90s.
Right. I mean, we've got two periods of Edward Gorey's life on Cape Cod.
Yeah, fascinating. He had a great connection to most, if not all, of the theaters here in the Cape and Islands. And of course, as we mentioned, that 1979 Tony Award, it was Dracula first made its debut there on Nantucket. Was it 1973, I think, thereabouts? Catuit Center for the
John
Arts
Wolpe.
Center for the Arts was one that he spent a lot of time at, and I think you've
a different
got
building.
Yeah, yeah, you've got a big part of what you're.
Yeah, he was. You know, ended up in the last years, he was going from theater to theater to theater, and he ended up at the Catuit Center for the Arts in an old garage behind a pizza place in Catuit. And he was happy. He felt like he had sort of, you know, found his place there. And because he had various arrangements at the other theaters, and I don't think they ever really felt, you know, like any place that was going to last for him. But he was very comfortable there, and it seemed like he'd found a place where he could do his rehearsals and put on his shows and sort of in a like-minded community of people. And so I have lots of footage of him sitting next to the wood stove with the leaky roof and all the buckets placed around there. It was really an old garage, and it was the wood stove that ended up burning the building down, so now they have a whole new place. I don't know if Edward lived to see it burn down.
I don't think so. I can't remember what year that was. But perhaps it was the quirkiness.
I think it was that
the
same year, actually, yeah, just right after.
Maybe it was the quirkiness of the old garage that attracted him somewhat.
He loved grassroots. You know, he didn't like fancy things. So anything really just was, you know, he'd sit on his couch. A couch that was rolled into this garage and across the room from the actors with the puppets on their hands, and he would go through long periods just watching, letting them horse around and do things that he didn't necessarily want them to do without comment, and some of it was social for him. It was kind of, you know, it was definitely not an afterthought or a retirement activity for him. He was really into theater, and he started out his career in the theater. And he had huge ideas about theater in terms of his influences. So he was taking it all very seriously, but he directed in his own way that was really much more of like a friend directing you.
Yeah. They're telling me the fire was in April of 2000, which was the same month that he died. He won that Tony, and this is an interesting story, Ken. He won that Tony for costume design, but he really thought he should have gotten it for set design. So tell us what he did with that Tony.
Well, you're exactly right, and I think most of the people who enjoyed seeing the production thought the sets were the most noteworthy. But he was straight up annoyed. He thought it should have gone the other way, and he gave the Tony Award away to a friend.
And luckily that friend gave
and
it back.
That friend has loaned it back, so it's on display at the Edward Gorey House Museum.
Yeah. I have to say, in that room with the Dracula, there's some great, that Dracula wallpaper, it's you got to see it.
There are a lot of really neat things to see at the Edward Gorey House, yeah, and there's a new exhibit every spring.
What's the exhibit this year?
He had a small press of his own, the Fantod Press, that he... I think I've got this right, that he self-published a number of his books, including some of his more famous ones. In fact, I think including The Deranged Cousins. Mm. So this the exhibit this season, spring, summer, fall, will be the Fantod Press and a lot of the original drawings and the books and the art that go with that.
That's good. And it's open in April, right?
Yes. We try to open every spring on the anniversary of his death.
Oh, okay.
But it always opens on a Thursday. So the museum opens on Thursday, April 17th.
Okay. And if folks want to check out our website, capeandislands.org, we have a slideshow up there from our visit in 2009. And I believe the Dracula wallpaper is in there as well. So let's talk about his relationship with children. We have these children's books, but he didn't really like or dislike them, right?
Well, if you were just going from his art, you'd think he had a humorous but negative view of children.
Mm-hmm. You brought along a clip from the Dick Cavett Show?
Yeah, that's right. It's one of the few times where I was able to find anything where he talked about how he thought about children, and he particularly, specifically refers to Ken in that.
Do you like children?
I don't really know any. I have one small first cousin once removed who will be 11 this year, and it's about the only child I know to any extent.
So you might like them if you happen to run across one.
I'm not one of those classic people who would feel comfortable with children, who children crowd around and say, oh, do tell us a story, and who they have to be dragged away the way, very like Edward Lear was reputed to have, children fell in droves at his feet kind of thing.
So as the 11-year-old, what was he like?
Well, I think Dick Cavett had it exactly wrong there, that if he'd been exposed to more children, he would have not liked them. I was 11 years old, as he just said, which makes it 1978, the year after Star Wars came out. Mm-hmm. And I think I was an annoyance.
Oh, is that right?
Well, making, all the stormtrooper noises and all that stuff. I there was a period of a few years where I basically learned that if I was annoying in a certain way, he'd pay me to go away. And I took that money and spent it at the arcade.
Absolutely. So one of the things that he liked to do, and I think your mother, and sometimes you tagged along, were for yard sales. He would go to these yard sales and buy kind of unusual things.
Yeah, if you visit the Edward Gorey house, you'll see what's left of a lot of what I'd call his art installations in his house, the things he'd get at yard sales were the same object over and over and over, like cheese graters or cobbler's pliers. And then he'd arrange them artistically, so that these odd objects would look like, say, a herd of animals, but they're actually pliers.
Yeah. He obviously had a great organizational eye to be able to do something like that.
Right. There was a period of time where I realized that what he was looking for oddly shaped pieces of metal. And so when we'd end up at a new yard sale, I'd often try to find those things first. it had to do with the shape of things. And often the objects he'd find at yard sales would later, years later, maybe you'd see a drawing of it, on the periphery of a larger drawing.
Wow. He also bought stuffed animals.
He made stuffed animals.
But he also buy.
He did.
Yeah.
He
that would be my next thing.
Oh, okay,
was the
right.
But he said something like every child in Cape Cod must have 50 stuffed animals because there's so many in these yard sales.
And the ones he seemed to gravitate towards were the ones that were most beat up. The teddy bear that no longer had any fur and was missing an eye.
That doesn't surprise me. All right. So talk about the ones that he made. He stuffed them with rice.
They were stuffed with rice. For years he just made frogs to his own design, and eventually expanded out to cats, bats, elephants, dragons, some imaginary creatures like the fig bash.
Mm-hmm.
And he seemed to always need to be doing something with his hands. If he wasn't drawing, it was often sewing.
Yeah. And you, because the rice attracted mice, you as a kid got to experiment with your various surgical operations on these stuffed animals.
He made them at the rate of almost one a day. And so they just piled up, and there was a trunk full of them that he left in the attic at the Barnstable home. And I opened it one spring, and the mice had gotten in. So it was time for me to do surgery. And, little did I know that 30 years later, each one of those is considered a piece of Edward Gorey's art.
Yeah.
It has value.
Yeah. A lot of value. He sold them for $25 at his plays and gave the money to the actors.
Yeah.
But they were but they're now worth probably $500-$600 each.
Yeah, that's amazing. He seemed like he always had to keep busy. He was always doing something.
he was using his hands.
Yeah.
I mean, he couldn't just watch TV. He was also sewing. He was obviously he's using his hands when he's doing his art. Chris can probably talk to. I mean, he was very gestureful.
Well, one of the things, just getting back to the sewed animals and the stuffed animals, you know, the week that he died, I was in his house documenting the way he left it. You know, I was in there shooting his house while he was alive. I shot it, you know, just after he died. And I was surprised to see, you know, the ongoing exhibit of his stuff. His house changed. You know, he would move his things around. You'd see sort of an exhibit of objects one day, and then the next day you'd be in there and it would change. He was like his personal art exhibit. But I opened his refrigerator to see, you know, a lot of people out there can relate, you know, what's in Edward Gorey's freezer? You know, what's
what was, you know, in there?
I wanted to know, you know. Just I was still trying to figure out who he was and what type of person he was. But you open it up and, you know, he had Stouffer's frozen meals and you know, mocha flavored coffee additive, and, you know, but he had in the drawer in the side panel of the freezer, he had fig bashes. Mm-hmm. And I think in the refrigerator and the freezer, he had stuffed fig bashes that were being preserved. I'm not sure if they were finished or not. I think they were half finished. Probably he had them in Ziplocs.
But and, why in the, I have photos why in of the refrigerator and the freezer?
Just to preserve them, probably maybe to keep the mice out.
I'll keep the mice out, I got you. Huh,
there shouldn't have been mice around, though, with all the cats.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That cat wasn't doing its job, right? We're talking about Edward Gorey's days on Cape Cod. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number if you'd like to join our conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so he liked movies. He liked to watch movies. And he would, especially some of the obscure movies that were around, right? And we have a clip of him talking about movies. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, I have to say my comment on that is he's talking in a way that's totally, you know, ignoring the question that I've asked him. Mm-hmm. I've asked him something about his work, and he's decided he's going to talk about other things. So this, and he would go on like this for 20 minutes without me saying anything more, as a way of avoiding the question I asked him. So we would get a lot of this material without asking for it.
And I would say that we had to cut this because I think it was like 6 or 7 minutes long. So yeah. We just took a clip of this.
And it ends up being some of the most interesting stuff.
Well, I remember years ago, there was an article in somewhere or other about who has been in the most movies you've never seen. It was Donald Sutherland, hands down. Well, partly because, of course, he was Canadian. So, but at that time, there was something like 11 movies that Donald Sutherland had been in that had never been released. Half of them had been made in Canada, half of them had been made in the United States. Probably now, of course, they're all on cable. You can see Donald Sutherland any day of the week.
And he talked about, I think I gasped when he said, you know, Vanessa Redgrave can't act and Meryl Streep. And yeah, he just, he likes to stir things up.
He likes to talk about Donald Sutherland when you ask him about the meaning of his work. Is what he likes to do.
Ken, you're laughing. Is that typical Edward?
We used to go to movies together occasionally back in the 70s, and I was a little kid, so you know I loved Star Wars, of course, and Edward hated it, which was the beginning of trying to figure out what he would like and what he wouldn't like. And I don't know if this is right, but my ultimate conclusion was that what he really didn't like was pretension, mm-hmm. things aiming too high, people get, you know, putting on airs. Mm-hmm. And so an obviously mediocre movie that wasn't trying to be anything more than an obviously mediocre movie, he might love. And the thing that was, you know, Oscar worthy would be beneath his contempt.
Interesting. Who were his friends? Who did he hang around with?
In his years on the Cape in Yarmouthport, he had a good number of very close friends. Jack Brangington Smith of Jack's Outback was one of his closest friends, and Rick Jones, who is now the director and curator of the Edward Gorey House, who was actually with Edward when Edward had his heart attack. Mm. Rick's been a great friend to Edward when he was alive, and has been great you know, in honoring his legacy ever since.
Yeah. Chris, is the documentary all Edward? Do you have any of do you talk to Ken and Rick and some of the
other
people?
Good question. At the state that it's in now, which is, you know, an early rough cut, I'm starting out with just him. Mm-hmm. I have interviewed at least a dozen people, other people, about him, you know, some people who were inspired by him, some, you know, who were his friends. I have that material and I'm waiting to add that in because I really am starting with Edward, mm-hmm. on Edward. And the whole thing ideally was supposed to be Edward, you know, narrating his own movie. Mm-hmm. So I was shooting interviews and shooting his activities. And then I would later on marry those interviews talking about, you know, things that were related that I had shot. And I shot about 60 hours of stuff. It was shooting to do maybe 200, 300, which is, wow, typically how much, you know, that's, if you set about it like a job, you would shoot 3 or 4 hours a day for 2 months. Mm-hmm. That's about 240 hours of material. It's not that much really in this, mm-hmm. in this field. So I got 60 hours of stuff, which sounds like a lot, but it wasn't what I set out to do. So I will be adding other material. At this point, I'm not. The stuff I'll be screening is just going to be Edward. I'm not bringing anyone, mm-hmm. else into it, but I have lots of interviews.
Yeah. And we didn't mention that we have two screenings that we're doing. March 2nd at the Catoit Center for the Arts, which is sold out. But we do encourage you to get on the wait list because, you know, we could have a pretty good wait list and we'll see what happens. And the other one is Nantucket on March 9th, which there are still some tickets for. And you can get information on that at our website, capeandislands.org. They are free, but you do have to reserve your seat. Talk, Chris, a little bit about the challenges of having your subject die halfway through your project.
Yeah. You know, I sort of grieve it a bit at this point because, you know, I was young. I only had a few years experience under my belt when I was shooting this. And if I was presented with the same situation now, I like to believe I would set about it with a much more brutal approach in terms of getting the material. Back then, I was really trying to just sort of, you know, become his friend and work my way into his world, you know, in a natural way, not, you know, artificial. I was interested in the guy. It was hard to pick up a camera when he was talking because he was so interesting. But I was really taking the slow approach. I didn't want to, you know, it was like hunting deer. You didn't want to make him bolt. Mm-hmm. And right when he died, I really felt like I'd hit that sweet spot of like, now I'm getting the stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, I got some pretty good stuff, but it's, luckily, my approach was sort of appropriate to the subject, and I think that's what he responded to. My background in anthropology really was appropriate. My sense shooting him was that he was sort of indeed the last of a disappearing race. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that's the sense you get with Edward. He was the last member of some race, maybe an alien race, you know. But, you know, the thing with Edward was there was no race. It was only ever Edward. He was the most one-of-a-kind person you'd ever meet. So I did approach it with, you know, a real sense of the importance of what I was doing, I think, because it was a unique thing for me to have that kind of access. And I knew it was important at the time. And so I did some things that, you know, I did a lot of things that I think, you know, really worked. And I was really, you know, a lot of my best stuff was in a parallel universe when he's still alive, probably. Mm-hmm. I was supposed to be shooting him doing his work, starting with a blank, fresh sheet of paper and creating something right before the camera. And we had it all set up one day. And he said, why don't you meet me at Jack's Outback and we'll go back to the house and do that. And I did. And we got to the house and he just, in Edward's own way, refused to do it, mm-hmm. and instead gave me like an hour interview at his kitchen table. So I resigned myself to letting Edward direct his own movie,
right?
Essentially. So I wasn't in total control, and that's one of the things I did right. But it didn't totally make for a movie that was going to happen quickly.
Yeah. Ken, do you think Edward would have done it had he not been able to have that kind of control?
No, Chris and I were talking the other day about you know, the parallels between Cats and Edward Gorey's personality, and I think there's some truth to the observation that you know, as long as he could do more or less what he wanted to, he was friendly and accommodating and so on. But if you tried to push him at all, mm-hmm. He would shut down pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Edward Gorey's life on Cape Cod with Christopher Seifert, who's working on a documentary, The Last Days of Edward Gorey, and Ken Morton, Edward's first cousin once removed. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking about Edward Gorey's days on Cape Cod with filmmaker Christopher Seifert, who's working on a documentary, The Last Days of Edward Gorey, and Ken Morton, Edward's first cousin once removed, working on a book of photographs of Edward's days on the Cape. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. If you have a Edward Gorey story or question for us, that's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I think his love of cats is certainly well known. Did he like other animals, or was it just particularly cats?
Cats were his first love, and he had five at the time of his death. And when we were all in the same summer house in Barnstable Village, every segment of my family had their own cats. So there were times where there were as many as 10 cats all in the same house. But to speak to your question, as I said earlier, he left his entire estate to various animal charities, and he specified three. One was Bat Conservation International. One is the Xertzi Society for the Preservation of Invertebrates, which my take on that was the bats need to eat. They eat the invertebrates, so protect the bats' food supply. Yeah. And the third thing was the Animal Rescue League.
Right. Yeah.
So in that sense, he was for all animals.
Exactly. Let's talk to Fran, who's giving us a call from Orleans. Hi, Fran.
Hi. I hate to go back, but I just wanted to talk about, I saw the production of Dracula on Broadway when I was in graduate school, and it was a transformative experience. And I taught theater for 26 years, and I never failed to mention that production at least once in a class, sometimes more. Because it was so beautiful, and I think he should have won for both because of the way the designs were so integrated. But it was the most spectacular show I ever saw.
Yeah,
honestly.
Yeah, lucky you, Fran. You got to see that. Yeah.
Yeah, it was just beautiful, and everything about it was so fabulous. So I just wanted to say that you know, even now I can describe it in detail. That's how impressive it was. You know, how many years later.
Yeah. Fran, thanks for calling. Thanks for sharing that with us. Appreciate that. Barbara is calling from Florida. Hi, Barbara.
Hi. I live in Brewster most of the year, and I want to tell you how much I am enjoying this conversation because I am such an admirer of Edward Gorey. We do go every year to make a pilgrimage to his home, and I just want to add that whenever I see anything of his and the Mystery Theater logo, it really breaks my heart to know that he's no longer with us. And I'd like to know, I have two questions. How old was he when he had his heart attack?
75.
And also, you mentioned something that he keeps in Ziplocs in his freezer, and I couldn't quite understand what that was.
Those were the stuffed fig bashes that he would sew with cloth and stuff with rice. And sell them at the shows to benefit his unpaid actors.
Yeah. Yeah. Maybe the question is,
what is a fig bash? Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Which
why that name?
Because it's a funny name. I think. I mean, he loved to play with language, and I think he just stumbled on fig bash in the same way that he came up with Gashlycrumb, or any of the various names of his characters throughout his work.
Yeah.
And then the reason for the freezer is that they're stuffed with rice, and I think it was to keep them safe from little creatures.
From creatures, yeah.
Although the cats would certainly have done that.
Yeah, well, I guess maybe sometimes the cats weren't doing their job.
or it might have been that the house was so cluttered he just needed a place to put them.
Yeah. Barbara, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate that. He also sometimes wrote under different names. I mean, right?
Well, he loved to play with not just language, but with individual words. And he published under dozens of different anagrams of Edward Gorey. Ogdred Weary is one of my favorites, but Ms. Regera Dowdy, Dog-Ear Ride, and on and on. In fact, the last of the Amphigory anthologies has a list of all the anagram names he ever used right on the front.
Yeah. We mentioned his love of movies. He obviously had a love of books. 25,000 books in his collection.
He had a big library. And he also had a tendency to, if he wanted to reread something, rather than go find it, he'd just go buy another copy. Mm-hmm. I think he had all of Agatha Christie multiple times over.
Right. Yeah. And as a matter of fact, I think when we did an interview a few years back, you mentioned that he had more books than the library that's next door.
Right. Yeah. I can also...
And not just books, movies, VHS tapes, CD collections.
He collected everything.
All media.
Everything. Yeah,
all
media.
And a lot of these things were still shrink-wrapped.
Right. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Okay, we have to talk about the music for the film. The score is performed by Cape-based musician Jacqueline Swab, who's done many soundtracks, including all of Ken Burns. How did you manage that?
It goes back a long way. I also, by the way, I did get other musicians have worked on it too. Justin McCarthy, Abigail Drake, a few other people. I'm still in process with it. But back in the early 2000s, I put an ad in NewEnglandFilm.com and for classical pianists to do a very specific list of music, and these were tracks that he used in his productions in the plays here, and I had done some things with Edward for we did Cautionary Tales for Children play for TV in the studio, which we never released. This was one of the things he wanted me to do for him that I said, look, I'll just do it, you know. And but we ran into some problems with copywriting all the music because he was using CDs. So the plan was to have all these tracks performed by musicians here locally. So after he died, I continued with that effort with the idea that someday maybe this will get out if the estate allows it, and that also I would use this music for the documentary soundtrack, because I'm not going to be using stock music for an Edward Gorey documentary. Right. So we're using some really great musicians to do this stuff, and it's been a job trying to track down what music he used by someone who doesn't know classical music that well, like me. You know, his programs say music by Debussy, Mozart, and Beethoven. And then I have to sit there and play the tapes back and then listen to all the stuff at iTunes and figure out what tracks they are.
Which.
And then
tell
that to a musician. I need you to play this.
Right. And so we have a clip here of Jacqueline's music. Let's see what this is. What is it called here? Clair de Lune. Did I say that right? Let's take a listen. Beautiful. She's such a great pianist. Yeah, we'll hear a little bit more of that in a few minutes. But we also have a sample of Edward talking about his work. And this is, I guess you say, his sort of how he uses some comedy and when some of the answers that he gives to you isn't always very
serious. He was extraordinarily self-deprecating and, you know, would use that for comedic effect.
I would say offhand that was fatal for an actor to have an image of themselves.
I mean, to be attached to any...
Well, or something. I mean, you know, I don't do this kind of thing, or this is beneath me, or... I can see this show isn't right for me, but not as a blanket thing or anything that was even very obvious necessarily. I mean, one kind of two shows that seem very much alike, one might be good for you and one might not. What's like illustrating a book? Some books I can illustrate, some I can't, and only I know for sure. Not that I haven't illustrated a lot of books I was no good for, but only I realized it, or at least as far as I know.
What would those be?
Oh, I can think of. Oh, I've done more awful work than you believe humanly possible. I don't like to think about it. I like to take the positive attitude and open up my little portfolio. Oh, isn't that nice?
I'm just envisioning you going through this and editing some of this stuff where you ask a question and it goes in a whole other direction.
Oh, it's extremely difficult. Plus, you know, you're in Jack's Outback with people talking. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to, yeah. I mean, just talking to the guy, I have so many instances where he's so interesting to talk to. And I'm the type of guy that, you know, wanted to talk about the Red Sox. Mm-hmm. I don't have a huge crossover with Edward. I mean, he outpaces me talking about music, art, or whatever in 8 seconds. But it didn't matter. He was still just a blast to talk to. The places his mind would go and his sense of humor, he's one of the funniest people I've ever met. Mm-hmm. It's like, sitting down with, you know, talking to Jerry Seinfeld over lunch. He was just really funny guy. Yeah. And, you know, this is like the elephant in the room here, right? How many people out there are just shocked at his voice? Mm-hmm. This is not the voice you're expecting coming out of this guy.
Yeah. Ken, what are you, is he one of the funniest guys you've ever, I mean, and sometimes do you know he's kidding? Because he does everything sort of in that, you know, flat.
He had tended to have extreme opinions. Mm-hmm. I didn't personally think of him as funny. But you know, my experience with him, I was a child, mm-hmm. and I didn't even really appreciate that he was an artist or famous until much, much later.
Yeah. Chris, talk about his thought on actors. He didn't really want them to act.
Yeah, he had this very devoted core of people here. I'm sure many of them are listening right now. I know they'll be going to the screenings, but he enjoyed – I got the sense that he picked his actors because he enjoyed – he wanted to know them. Mm-hmm. And he enjoyed hanging out with them. And the actors was sort of like – the acting was a secondary thing. He took it very seriously, but he wanted everything to be impossibly deadpan and flat. And the actors, you know, used that as an optional thing, I think. You know, generally, these were professional actors. Some of them have big screen credits to their name, and as many do, people ending up on Cape Cod. But they, you know, he would voice how frustrated he was that they would sort of not overact, but act. He didn't really want them to act, which is, if you're an actor, right?
That's what you do.
You know,
yeah.
That's difficult. So they might change something for a time or two and then end up right back, you know, at the way they wanted to do it originally. That was his complaint. They're just going to do it anyway, so why even start? Yeah. So I think the clip, one of the clips you have is Cautionary Tales for Children, where he narrates in the way that he wanted to do it, and then you hear the actors basically going all over the place, you know, acting.
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't have time to play that.
Oh, okay.
One. So, but
I set that up.
We'll put it on the website though, so people can hear it. So, Ken, when do you think the book will be out? Is it going to be a while?
Well, that's pretty much on my shoulders to finish the writing. I hope it'll see the light of day sometime later this spring.
All right. And the film, we're hoping end of this year, Chris. What do we think?
The idea is that these are rough cut screenings that won't disqualify a Sundance submission. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be coming to Sundance, submitting to Sundance in September.
Right. All right. And so, again, our screenings are March 2nd and 9th. March 2nd is sold out, but please get on the waiting list if you'd like to. Maybe if we have enough, we can do another showing at another time. March 9th on Nantucket. There are still tickets available. They are free, but you do have to reserve in advance. CapeandIslands.org is our website. Also, we'll put links up to our visit to the museum in June 2009, as well as a slideshow of the museum. Chris Seifert and Ken Morton, thank you so much for being here. Look forward to the screenings.
Such a blast.
Thank you.
Thanks.
This was great.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.